Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, July 18th, 2013. Tonight's main science topic, I'll be talking about water and sewage wastewater management. Kind of a different topic for this show, but it's related to my recent ebook released July 4th called Simply Water. One word, title Water. And that book is a primer, let's put it that way. It's something to give me a platform because so many of these topics, they have a huge amount of information. There's many related topics, and wastewater management is one of the main offshoot topics. Water, the ability to get fresh water, usable water, potable water, that's one issue, but what do you do once you have it and use it? And I want to just make mention that personally, I've spent a lot of time recently, it's consumed a bit of my time, but it's worth it, I have become energy, water, and resource. My footprint I've reduced to zero, and I try and keep it that way, related to my business activities and scientific activities. That can take more, but my personal footprint I have reduced to zero. In other words, the amount of energy, water, and resources that I use, the way I live, I put back to the earth equal amount or more. And you think, well, gee, how can a person do that? And it's actually possible. It's called sustainability. And that's not a new word. Of course, that's not a word I invented or... But there's an additional concept that I have put with the word sustainable. Many people are out there and they think if they just do sustainable things, everything will be great. The world would be a wonderful place. But there are some opposing forces. Let's put it that way. I have a write-up on my webpage, kind of a small write-up. And basically what it amounts to is the fact that, let me just read it here verbatim off my webpage. It says, my new ebook, Water Promotes a Sustainable Society. There is no other book with the exposure of details that you will find in this ebook. Many people talk about sustainable societies, but you will never achieve it on a large scale unless you know what is opposing your efforts. And of course, that is the key. You can have all kinds of city planning. You can have planned sustainable communities. You can do it on a personal scale. But what's preventing this world from moving forward to have sustainable lifestyle? That means a lot less investment, a lot less expense, a lot less cost. And so you have to understand, there is no profit in a sustainable society economic model. It's not a profit-driven economic model. In a banker's world, economic profit maximization model, with control of resources to rape the public of their labor and last penny, and finally, with the leadership in the hands of the banker pawns, we are in for a world struggle for basic survival. So my book gives a to-do list of things we must start doing on a societal and individual basis to regain our birthright to water. And so anyway, sustainability, it's a swell term, and a lot of people throwing it around, a lot of people thinking sustainability, but you're never going to achieve it unless you understand the forces that are working against you. And I was on the John Moore show yesterday morning, and I made the point that that a lot of people will, well, we got to impeach Obama, or we got to do this, or back in the Clinton days, there's always been an impeach the president process going on. And don't worry about it. Don't waste your time and energy. Those people are middle management. If you replace or if you impeach one of them or get them out of office, they'll have somebody in there tomorrow that's going to do the same thing. So don't waste your resources. Those straw horses are put up there to divert you, the public. So So anyway, that is part of the main science topic tonight, but the issue I'll be delving into is water sewage waste management. We have a real problem in the advanced so-called first world, the advanced so-called advanced countries. But we have a huge water problem. We're making a mess out of water. Let's just look at the issue of antibiotics and prescription drugs. These are chemicals. You take them, they go through your body, they do whatever they're going to do, good or bad, whatever, but afterwards that's flushed out of your body. It goes into the waste, the human waste, urine, solid waste, and it goes into a toilet and it goes down the drain into the water purification system. They call it water purification, but it's anything but that. And all of these chemicals then get dumped back in the water table. So this is not solving any problems. And so what happens? Here's an issue, a real issue, that as you drink water from the tap, you're drinking antibiotics constantly in food and processed food, anything that has you get some orange juice from the store that has had water added to it from it's orange juice from concentrate. It's mainly water that's added at some point. That water has antibiotics in it that and they're building and building and building over time. People pour their old prescriptions down the toilet or wash them down the sink. So at any rate, the issue is that we are doing cumulative pollution. One of my critical aspects of my new book, Water, is that the EPA, instead of the Environmental Protection Agency, I call it the Environmental Pollution Agency, because they permit little bits of pollution, and somehow they magically set a standard, something that's acceptable. It's okay to pollute a certain amount. And no, it's not okay because pollution is cumulative. If you just did it one time and say, okay, let's turn our heads. We did it one time, but we're not going to do it again. No. It's every day, all year long, decades of pollution, century of pollution, and it doesn't end. So the water is becoming extremely contaminated. And water, sewage, and waste management is a huge problem. I'll be talking more about that. Let me jump into a few other topics here first. I get a magazine. It's called Physics Today. It's something you get because you are a physicist and you went to physics training, you know, and it's kind of a popular magazine. It covers a lot of in-depth topics. But anyway, this last issue has an article on exoplanet atmospheres. And so at any rate, it comes back, of course, I deal with the formation of solar systems. Some people think, well, Jim McCanny, he deals with comets. No, that's not the whole story. That's a little teeny corner of what I do. The overall picture is solar system development. How did our solar system form? How do stellar planetary systems form in general? And of course, what I've said is that you start out with a twin star system, and then you adopt through gravitational capture, it's called. It's a process well known in celestial mechanics. You capture incoming objects with the twin star, and these then start building up a solar system. It's like a celestial game of billiards. It's very complicated, but the end product is a family of planets. And so new studies that have come out in the past 10 years show that planets around other stars, which are being discovered, they're actually seeing them. There's various techniques for observing them. What they're finding is that they have the big gas planets, like Jupiter, very near the star. And they're going, well, how can this be? This doesn't fit our model. One of the side aspects of the current standard model, where supposedly a nebular spinning cloud of dust collapsed and formed all the planets, Well, they say, well, the heavier elements were in towards the center, and so that's why we have the what they call the terrestrial planets, the ones with solid cores. Heavy or majority of the planet is solid core with an atmosphere around it, like Venus, Earth, and Mars, and then the big gas planets are out farther, like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Okay, so that's a nice result. You know, you got the gas planets out there, and you got the terrestrial-type planets in close, Mercury being another terrestrial planet close to the Sun. Okay, so they're kind of divided up like that. But then you got Pluto, that's, for all practical purposes, apparently, a terrestrial-type small planet, but that's way out beyond all the gas planets. And then recently you have discovered 40 other planets out there, and they all fit the model of more terrestrial, small-type planets. So anyway, the model breaks down, but you go to another star system, the Jupiter-like planets, the big ones, the big guy, the one big planet in that system, is right next to the star. It's in there close. So they're going, oh, well, it doesn't quite fit the model, but then there's a lot of hand-waving, yada yada, and all of a sudden, well, we're going to still keep the same model. It doesn't work. What I have said all along is that these twin star systems, the main star and its companion, its Jupiter-like companion, come out of the galactic center, and they can be any place. It's nothing magical. These are not forming from rotating clouds of dust and gas. That's not the situation at all. Then you start adopting new members into that solar system by capture. Okay, now the celestial mechanics of this would explain how the subsequent planets arrived. But that big gas planet next to the star, yeah, there's going to be a lot of those. Just like there's going to be some that have the secondary planet, gas planet, or small star, is, if you will be very far away from the main star. And so you have everything in between. But capture is the modus operandi of the star systems. That's the way it works. At any rate, then talking about the atmospheres of planets, I also talk about the fact that Earth is constantly gaining atmosphere. It's constantly gaining water. The water is coming into storm systems, and we can see this on radar. A big storm system develops and might be developing overnight, and it comes across, say up in the upper Midwest of the United States, or in Oklahoma, or say the far eastern United States. Okay, the cloud systems come in off the Pacific, and that's where they gain their water. Or they could gain the water from a wind, upper level wind cycle that brings air, moist air off the Gulf of Mexico. Once you leave that body of water, the Gulf of Mexico, the Baja Gulf, west of Mexico over the Baja, or in the Pacific Ocean, once the air leaves there, there's no more water to be had. All the way across, as that weather system moves across the United States, it has all the water it's going to get from the ocean. There ain't no more. There's no more to be had because that weather system is moving from west to east. Okay, so all of a sudden, let's say like a number of years ago, you have a big storm system. It develops in a few hours, and it dumps 12 inches of rain on Duluth, Minnesota. Where did the water come from? It was not in the air before. You could see it in the satellite images. You have the infrared radar that tells you the water content in the atmosphere all the way from the satellite all the way down to the surface of the Earth. You can see all the water. And all of a sudden, you have enough cloud system developing rapidly to dump 12 inches of rain in a 12-hour period on a small northeastern town in the upper Midwest. How does this happen? Where does that water come from? Well, it comes from the only place available up there. It comes from outer space. So this is an indication that exoplanets, or planets in our solar system, are gaining atmosphere constantly. Mars is gaining atmosphere. there's the story I always tell that back in the 70s, they sent a probe to Mars, and it was orbiting Mars, and one of its objectives was to measure the Martian atmosphere, its extent and density properties. And then they go, okay, here's the content, the type, the species of molecules and in the atmosphere of Mars. Here is the density, and then here is where basically the atmosphere ends and outer space begins, the vacuum of outer space. So all of these properties were measured. And so the idea being that the next spacecraft coming 10 years later would use aerobraking, a system in which you inflate a big, big balloon with a long attached to the satellite, and that balloon drags through the atmosphere, slows the spacecraft down that's arriving from Earth at a very high velocity. It slows it down and then slowly drops into the atmosphere. And then ultimately parachutes are deployed and it drops all the way down to the surface of the planet. Okay, that's called aerobraking. It's a system of braking the velocity of a satellite coming into the atmosphere. So 10 years later, the next satellite arrives at the planet Mars to do its aerobraking thing, and they're trying to get it down to a certain spot on the planet Mars. The atmosphere of Mars had doubled in size in a 10-year period. Well, how does that work? You know, and they brush it under the carpet like nothing happened. Nobody says anything about this. Atmosphere of the planets are increasing constantly. The planets are drawing in. Well, how did they do this? It's the plasma discharge comet model. All the planets are discharging the solar capacitor. They charge up to a negative potential because of the higher charge to mass ratio of the electrons, which are coming in from the sunward side, provides a net negative charge in the region of the planet. And so, therefore, it draws in positively ionized molecules from beyond, or atom species, and they combine to become molecules as they're falling in to the planet. But this is going on all the time, and Earth, Venus, the little planet Jupiter, or little planet Mercury, has a special tale to tell. It is so close to the sun that the solar wind just blasts it and rips its atmosphere away, and so it really cannot form a decent atmosphere that close to the sun. But the other planets, Venus, Earth, Mars, all are developing atmospheres continually. I also talk about the flood event, the Noah's flood, where the Earth was inundated for 40 days and 40 nights, but if you read the Bible closely, it's about 44 days that they actually recorded. And there doesn't seem to be a pole shift. There just seems to be a lot of rain. Well, the Earth passed through a comet tail. I once made a calculation that if Earth had passed through the tail of Comet Hale-Bopp at its full extent, we would have taken about 35 days to pass through the tail at the rate Earth goes around the sun. So this is just the reality of things. And if we would have passed through the tail of Comet Hale-Bopp, we would have been thrown into an ice age, glaciation, drop in the temperature of Earth, and we would be digging ourselves out of the next ice age. We would have had a mass extinction. A lot of people would have died, a lot of animals, and that's exactly what happened back then. So at any rate, the story is that atmospheres are changing. They're constantly changing, and that's another point I make in the water book that I had made before, but I emphasize it in the water book, that Earth has a very dynamic atmosphere. The standard science story, the standard meteorological story, is that Earth has a fixed atmosphere. When the dinosaurs were here, we had the same atmosphere as we have right now. And the end of story. Well, it isn't true. When the dinosaurs were here, we had a very different atmosphere. Prior to Noah, they had a very different atmosphere. It was said that the Earth supported a canopy of water. we had a very dense water-laden atmosphere. They didn't have tornadoes. They didn't have hurricanes. The weather systems were very different. They did not know about the rainbow. What is a rainbow? After it rains, that fine mist after a rain, the sun shines through the clearing atmosphere, and you get an internal reflection off the little teeny water droplets that are spherical, and it provides you with a rainbow. So, prior to the Noah's flood, they had never witnessed a rainbow before. It tells us that the atmosphere was very different back then. So, Earth's atmosphere, not only in these catastrophic events, but in the everyday, day-to-day weather, we have a changing atmosphere. People ask me about global warming. Well, it's not due to you driving up and down the road with your SUV. That has nothing to do with climate or weather. But we are warming up. It's very clear. The glaciers are melting. The ice caps are getting smaller every year. The data there is very clear. But then they try and relate it to the consumption of oil and what they call fossil fuels, another modern myth. The oil and the natural gas and the coal have nothing to do with fossils or dinosaur bones or whatever else they imagine, fern forests. No, there's water. There are oceans of oil under the water, 18 miles deep in the Gulf of Mexico and other places around the world. So the point being that the Earth's atmosphere is in flux constantly changing. And we've had big events where it changes on a dramatic scale very quickly, worldwide scale. These local storms that I was talking about before, where it rains heavily, or a lot of water comes in, influx into a storm system from outer space, is of a more rare event, but it's going on all the time also. And then some people say, well, what happens with all this water? Wouldn't we see the ocean levels rising rapidly? And the answer is that there is a hydrologic cycle by which when it rains, then that water evaporates and comes back up into the cloud system. And as it evaporates, it moves up and in the northern hemisphere moves in a northerly direction. In the southern hemisphere, it moves in a southerly direction. And after about four or five cycles of this evaporation rain cycle, or snow if that's the case, if it's winter time in that hemisphere, that eventually, all that water eventually ends up towards the poles, where it becomes permanently encased in the polar region, in the ice caps. But of course now the rate of evaporation, the rate of the water production from the ice caps, that is outpacing the production of ice by the hydrological cycle. So we are in a definite warming period, but the point about global warming is that we are just getting back to normal. We're just getting back to normal. And so, as I said, it's not about you driving your SUV up and down the road. And there are some very distinctive cause and effect issues going on. But the real issue with oil and the consumption of energy is we consume way too much energy, we burn way too much oil. That should be the central focus of the issue, not some secondary greenhouse effect that might happen in 50 years. So the topic of exoplanets and their atmospheres, it's a good one to discuss because we are a planet that has all of these same conditions. I could go on a whole couple shows on that particular topic. There's another one that has been in the news recently, and it's called they're looking for something called the God particle, the Hughes boson particle that's in they're searching for. It has to do with unification of fields, and so kind of an esoteric topic of physics. But they call it the God particle because what they think is if they discover it, it will take the place of God. And so that's why they call it the God particle. But anyway, there's another aspect to the whole question of was there a creator or not. And the current trend in thinking that's rather being rammed down the throats of the scientific community, and this very subtly filters into the public, is the idea that you don't need God in science. Science can explain everything you see without a God. And so I have to find this almost comical because that puts men, mortal men, here in the year 2013, putting themselves in a position where they think they know everything. They think they have all the answers. So what they do is they combine the Big Bang concept, saying that that explains the beginning. So you don't need God. Why would you need God if there's a Big Bang? And then all of the production of atoms and the atomic structure and particles all happens in an instant, and then this amazing organization comes out of one spot in the universe. Well, you know, it doesn't cut the mustard. My book, The Diamond Principle, goes into the logical arguments regarding the organization of the universe. Even if you had a Big Bang and everything came out chaotically and all of a sudden began to organize, you would have parts of the universe where things were different. Things just work differently. Every hydrogen atom, whether it's on this side of the universe or the far side of the universe, every hydrogen atom has the same spectroscopic residue, the light coming off of the hydrogen atom or the hydrogen molecule or other compounds that are made from hydrogen with other atoms and molecules. The signatures are the same on the other side of the universe, and we can see them. We can see them through telescopes. So how did this amazing organization, simplistic organization, carry over to the far side of the universe if it blew up 13 billion years ago and this is all just random? Well, the whole idea to me is silly. Let me jump to the page here. There's an article in Physics Today, page 53. This is in the July issue. It says the God problem. And the thing I want to point out here is the book is authored by somebody named Howard Bloom. When I released my the Diamond Principle book, I released it on Coast to Coast. They received their copy, and we went through a standard release show. I was scheduled to be on a particular night to do the release, and up to that point, the book was already off and selling and pre-selling. But what they did was rather strange, and I had released many books on Coast to Coast, The Atlantis to Tesla, The Colvin Connection, my weather book, Calculate Primes, and on, and now The Diamond Principle. But they put another person on the air with me. His name was Howard Bloom. The guy who's writing the book, The God Problem, the subtitle is How a Godless Cosmos Creates. And so it's very interesting. The entire point of my book, The Diamond Principle, was that there is a creator. There's an observable that there is a creator. And it's very simple. One night I was on Art Bell show. It was a Christmas special back in the 90s. And we were talking about the Russian space program. And that came up, and Art was somewhat of a declared atheist. He didn't believe that there was a creator. And I said, okay, well, let's look at this. If you see a bridge that's down, you know, was built before you were born, let's say, you're looking at a bridge or some kind of construction. I say, was there an architect to that building? Well, the answer, of course, if you see that building, there had to be an architect, a plan, all the plumbing, all of the everything else that goes in the building, the structure, the making sure the materials will support the upper levels of the building, a lot of engineering. It probably had to be signed off and the design approved by a staff of building inspectors. And you just assume that all this had to happen. I mean, but basically, in the very beginning, there was a design. Somebody sat down with a piece of paper and drew out all of the floors and the levels so that the builders, the contractors, could follow that and construct the building. And without that, you don't just go and say, okay, well, let's build a building, and you start putting bricks down. No, you have a very set design. But the point is that, you know, 50 years later, somebody comes along and sees that bridge or the building, and in the case of a bridge, it has to support weight, it has all kinds of design criteria so that it stands and withstands weather and who knows what else, but it had to have a designer, and you just simply look at it and you assume there was. And so anyway, the point is that, yes, there was a designer. Did you ever meet the designer or the engineer that worked on the project or the construction manager? No. Was there? Was there a person in each element of this construction? Well, yes, there had to be. Were there workers that put it up and put it together? Yeah. There was all of the elements of constructing that building. So when you look at the universe and the organization and construction of the universe, doesn't that indicate to you that there was a creator, a master design? And you see that master design when you look at the point of the Diamond Principle. The opening part of the Diamond Principle book says that if you found a diamond on Earth, and you were the first guy ever to find a diamond, and you looked at it, would you think, oh, this is the only diamond, and I found it, and I'm going to harbor it, and it's the only diamond in the world? No, you would start looking for more. And as you found more, they're going to look different. Each one has its own characteristic. But the formation process for diamonds is the same. Even in the basic crystalline structure of the diamond, it's a carbon crystal is basically what a diamond is. It's a carbon crystal, and the structure of that crystalline structure is standard in, and you can observe why that is because of the number of valence electrons in the carbon atom. And the point is that on the very far side of the universe, if you dug up a diamond, it would look the same. It might have a different shape, it might have different cracks or internal characteristics, but the crystalline structure of diamond, the carbon crystalline structure of diamond, is going to be the same. There's a master plan here. How did the diamond on the far side of the solar system know to be the same as ours? Well, it's because of the carbon atom. Hydrogen, I talked about in the water book, I talk about hydrogen being the most common element in the universe. And so you look all over the universe, no matter where you look, hydrogen has the same characteristic spectrum. The light given off follows the same rules. How did it know to be the same over there as it is here and not a little bit different? And so the end result is, yeah, there had to be a creative design. And through that design, you recognize a creator or some moving element. And so you, as an individual or human, you have to understand we have a tremendously finite amount of information. So for someone to be as pompous, arrogant, and self-serving as to believe that you don't need a creator, that all of this is just random and it just kind of happened, and because you believe in a Big Bang, where the universe began in one shot, is ludicrous. It's absolutely absurd. But the reason I'm going through this is because Howard Bloom was the guy they invited to the guy, this author now of this book, The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates. They invited him to be on the same show with me when I released The Diamond Principle. Well, clearly The Diamond Principle goes against the grain of the banking, the world bankers. They want to push this atheist view of science onto the public. And that's a very subtle aspect of this promotion of atheism in science, that somehow science can explain everything and you don't need a creative force to be a creative force in the formation of the universe. At any rate, and I thought it was rather humorous that they mentioned, well, they mentioned Einstein and a number of other people, but they mentioned that Einstein was a believer in the creative process, that the universe had a creator, and you see this because of the order and organization of the universe. And they also mentioned in the article that Stephen Hawking was in agreement with that. And actually, his last book that he wrote himself was the very last paragraph in the entire book, says that this organization of the universe is your key. This is the thing that opens the door for you to understand that there is a creative force in the universe, that this organization is just not haphazard. But oddly enough, as I was releasing The Diamond Principle, the next week, I think it was August 15th, or around that time period, around 2010, when I released The Diamond Principle, within a week, there was a supposed book by Stephen Hawking that came out that totally reversed that statement of his previous real book, but it was co-authored. Someone had supposedly written a book with Stephen Hawking, but remember, he's in a wheelchair. He can't move. He's been invalid for decades, really. I saw him in, wow, it had to be 70s or 80s, and he was in a wheelchair then and did not look very good. So to imagine that somehow in 2010 he comes out and only one guy can talk to him and somehow interpret this, that he's changing his position on the concept of a godless universe. Anyway, just had to mention that. I could go on this, but this is just a side issue on this book. Let's see. Oh, there's another quick note here. A listener sent in, and many people actually sent this in, on trumpeting volcanoes. So I wanted to make a quick comment on this. Prior to eruption, many volcanoes give off a screaming, screeching noise. And, of course, there were screaming, screeching noises that the ancients talked about. So let me clarify this. Some of what the ancients were talking about when they talk about the sky monsters in the Kolbun and the tremendous trumpeting sounds in the heavens, these were the electrical discharges contacting Earth's upper atmosphere, vibrating and giving a high screeching pitch. It actually caused a lot of the people to go deaf at the time. It was so intense. So that's one type of atmospheric screaming, so to speak. But the other one, when a volcano is ready to go off, let's examine exactly what a volcano is. It is a underground fissure where water from the water table has dropped down in and touched the magma, the rock, molten rock core of Earth. And when it does that, when that water hits that magma, it turns to steam. And so what happens is the steam finds escape routes and gives you this tremendous steam whistle type of sound. So, yeah, volcanoes do vent, so to speak. And when that tremendous pressure is finding its way out and it's turning to steam underground and it's ready to blow the top off the volcano because it's basically a giant steam engine, that's going to make some noise, and that's a different type of screeching noise that the ancients talk about when they saw the great comets that came close to Earth. So at any rate, a little comment about that. And then also, I collect items that people send in over time. And so over time, I've collected some emails on criticism. I'm always real critical of other people, other entities like NASA or government agencies. But it seems I'm never critical of myself, at least on the air. Daily, I'm highly critical of myself. When I do things like the Calculate Primes work or the other work on, say, prime numbers, other math problems that I work on my own that you don't see. They're not, they're a little too esoteric to leave out to the public. Maybe someday I will release some of that information, but the point is I'm highly, highly critical of myself because I, in a lot of cases, I'm the only person to review my own work. Some people are saying that I'm not disciplined enough, I'm not doing enough, say, experimentation of, the, say, the comet ideas and other aspects of my work. But there is a lot of experimental verification. You just have to read closely what I'm writing in the books. You have to read closely to find it. Like, say, for example, the fact that the core of the sun is cooler. The Russians performed an experiment. I describe it in my weather book, and that's a very important result. But now also remember that none of this will ever be published in the so-called peer-reviewed respectable journals, because it goes against the grain of the, say, Big Bang. And by the way, the Big Bang is not true. That doesn't have a shred of truth to it. I was talking about that because they're using that to say that there's a godless universe. There's no God to create the universe, and they're basing this on the idea that the Big Bang is true. Well, the Big Bang concept is not true at all, and the reason is that the redshifts they're seeing, have been seeing since Hubble first started looking at these, the redshifts are due to the fact that there's a non-uniform electric field that is set up around the star. It's the induced electric dipole redshift that's causing the redshifted light or the bending of light around a star. So the Big Bang doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. It has no basis. So the point here is that they're using a theory which is bogus, bad science in astronomy, to prove that, or try and prove that there's no God or no design in the universe. Anyway, like I said, I could go on two shows about all of this and the details. On to the next topic. I was talking about the criticism of myself. And so I like people to criticize me, but also I should say that there's a lot of things that go on in the background that you never see, a lot of things that I'm doing. I have some efforts afoot to take my work to the next level, so to speak, and I won't go into a lot of detail. But, yeah, this is necessary, but it's a lot of work. It's a lot of time, and my weekly schedule is pretty full. And let's just take, for example, I told you this recently, which has taken me a long time and a lot of personal effort, to get into a position where I can reduce my energy, resource, water footprint to zero. To personally do it so that I knew what it would take for an individual to do it, so that if we tried on an earthwide scale to reduce our social footprint to zero, that it could be done. So anyway, that's a good topic to lead into the next. Let me just end that little discussion by saying I am very critical of myself, and I always strive to do more and work harder, and I probably do more in a day than most 10 people combined, including scientists that are paid by the government. But still, that doesn't mean I shouldn't try harder, do better, and I have major goals as far as information and organization of information to present to the public. And so anyway, about water sewage waste. We have an immense problem in this country and in the first world, in Europe, other places, in that, first of all, we have a very aging water distribution system and sewage system. Some towns have kept up, some cities have modern, what you would call modern systems. But I have heard that in the sewage systems, there are many breaks in the pipes, in the tubings, all over the country, and this is leaching out into the water system, and the cities don't really know about this. They don't have a way of fixing it. There are some solutions where they can come in and through the inside put like an internal tube in them, but that's expensive. The reality is that the first world countries are hitting that point. It's kind of like where you build a house. You build your brand new house, everything is new, everything works, but in about 10 years, the furnace needs to be replaced, the air conditioner's going out, the shingles need to be redone. You know, and over the period of the next 15 years, you're basically rebuilding your house with a lot of these expensive repairs in addition to paying your house payment. The infrastructure of water distribution and waste management is the same. In the United States, we have an aging, at best, a very aging water distribution and sewage maintenance system. But now the EPA, the federal EPA, has come out with a study saying that the United States is going to require close to $400 billion, that's with a B, that's $0.4 trillion, to upgrade its water distribution and management, waste management systems. But this has the World Bank, this has the loans. Where's all this money supposed to come from? Well, that means all the municipalities have to go out and get a loan. Well, who's there, Johnny on the spot, to give them the loan? Well, it's the World Bank through all their subsidiaries and through all of the pocket companies that are out there loaning money to cities. Just waiting because the federal legislation, which is another part of this, the EPA spearheading it, the federal government setting standards, and then all the local municipalities having to follow suit. And none of the states coming along and saying, hey, you guys don't have any business here. But, of course, they always butter it up with, well, if you do this, we'll give you money for water infrastructure and we'll provide grants, all of which is phony money in the first place. But the idea that is that the World Banks are poised to take over the local water systems, first through legislation to control and set standards, second of all for the World Bank to come in and give loans to the municipalities to upgrade to meet those standards, and then third, the simple ownership of water. But fourthly, and most importantly, who's going to pay for all of this plus interest? What's the interest on a $400 billion loan? It's a lot. Plus fees, plus all of the other money that goes along, overhead fees with the loans. So you're talking about the better part, by the time this is all done and paid for, you're talking a couple $1 trillion being stuffed down the throat of the American public. But wait, let's stop and take a look back. Should we even be upgrading the water waste management systems? Should we even have one? Should we have water-based toilets? Should we be pouring chemicals and prescription drugs and everything else under the sun down the sinks and toilets of the world? Should industrial waste be allowed to go into the sewage treatment plant? You know, what we're dumping into water out of sight, out of mind is just unbelievable. The antibiotics, let's look at all of the antibiotics in the animal husbandry industry, cows, pigs, chickens, turkeys, and everything else. All given antibiotics in their food on a daily basis. Then they, you know, have waste, and that gets dumped into the rain washes that away. And all of this goes back into the water table, the humans taking drugs, all of the drugs. Imagine if you had a giant warehouse and you could see at one time all of the drugs, the pharmaceutical prescription drugs that the American public, plus the non-pharmaceutical drugs, doesn't make any difference, that are eventually washed down into the sewer system. Whether if you don't take your entire prescription, some people just dump them in the toilet. But the ones that you take, the prescription drugs, they go through your body, they do whatever they're going to do, and then they come out in the liquid or solid waste, and that is not treated in the water treatment management plant. They don't do anything. All they do is they have a bioprocess which breaks down the human solid waste, and then they claim, this water is safe. But it has all the chemicals. Just look at what you use to clean your toilet. Some chemical goop that is the most caustic chemicals on the planet. People put a little blue cube or a little white thing on there with chlorine bleach going into the water system on a continual basis. All this goes into the water treatment plant. When you eat meat for supper and you clean the dishes, what do? You use phosphate soaps that'll break down the oil and clean your dishes, and then all of that fat, that animal fat, goes down the drain. And is that somehow broken down in the sewage treatment plant? The answer is no. All the chemicals that those animals have taken over their lifetime and accumulated in their bodies, all of that is going down the drain. The water it takes to butcher the cows and the pigs and the chickens and the ducks and the turkeys, etc., all of that water is then dumped back into the water system. At every step of the way, we're polluting water at a tremendous level. But the question is, should we be using water as the kind of the catch-all for all the pollution? And the answer is no. The simple result is that if you eat vegetables for supper, if you're a vegetarian and you simply eat vegetables, you can wash your plates with simple water. It will dissolve all of the vegetable matter, etc., and you can actually wash your plates with simple water, maybe a little bit of some types of natural disinfectant soap. But the point is that if you clean the plates, the germs will come off if you're using like a natural vegetable base soap, for example. There are many brands out there, I won't name any specifically, but there are many brands of naturally based biodegradable soaps for clothes, and they clean. They do a wonderful job of cleaning. I'll name a few: Amway, Shackley, some of those, and there are many others, of course. And I don't recommend any one over the other, these are vegetable-based soaps that don't pollute. They're biodegradable. That's the kind of thing we should be using on a wide scale. And then that can go down into the sewer system, into the waste management system, and now we're not dumping all kinds of harsh chemicals, we're not dumping antibiotics, all of the things here. People are losing their immune system simply by drinking water. You drink water, you're drinking antibiotics. If you're constantly taking antibiotics, then your immune system, your natural immune system, is becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. And those antibiotics are getting to the point where they don't work anymore because the viruses and bacteria are becoming resistant just because you're drinking water out of the tap. So think about it. This is the legacy we're leaving for the youth of this country and the future generations. In one or two generations, we're using all the easily obtained oil, natural gas, coal. We're using it all up. There's nothing left for future generations. This, and that's the what I call the banker world economic model, where they use all the resources, charge maximum dollar, and without any effort to reforest the earth, to bring it back to its original state. No, it's to use for maximum power, maximum profit, and now power, control of the public, control of water, control of oil, control of coal, control of natural gas, charging a fixed rate that's outrageous, that's easily 10 times what it should be. Water is going to be the very same. So if you look at this $400 billion investment plus interest being paid over the entire United States, your local water bill is going to go through the roof. And I know communities where these kind of things have already happened. Their infrastructure bill to upgrade their water systems due to federally mandated standards has gone through the roof, to the point where people are paying more for water than they are for heat and electric combined. Or if they're in areas where it's a warmer climate, for electric air conditioning, they're paying more for the water than they are for the other utility bills combined. That's already happening. And it's being kind of slid through so that the public doesn't know or recognize it. Water is the last frontier. The other issue is that we don't have a water shortage problem, we have a water management problem. My new book, Water, talks about the fact that it reiterates the fact that the management of water is being mandated by people who are making big profits. You have water bottling companies that are allowed to take water as much as they want out of the big Great Lakes, put it in plastic bottles and ship it off and sell it for a dollar a bottle. Talk about an expensive bottle of water, $1, $1.50. I've seen bottles of water for $2 and over $2 in the convenience store coolers. $2 for a little bottle of water. That's expensive water, and people, it's been inching up and inching up to the point where people don't even notice it. Okay, I just want to make you aware of my webpage, all of the water filter products that are there, so you can become water independent. Be your own source of clean, fresh water. And it's once you become water independent, your water cost for the rest of your life is almost free. Learn how to do that on my webpage, JMCC. S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo.com, seven letters, www.7lettersjmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.